This episode is brought to you by The Manor, a premier addiction treatment facility in the hills of Wisconsin's Kettle Moraine Forest. Their program offers a tailored approach to those struggling with addiction in a secluded setting with no more than 11 men and women. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantal Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love are struggling with addiction, call The Manor at 414-930-1930. You can learn more about The Manor by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting discoverthemanor.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm David Sauvage, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 150 for November 16th, 2021. This episode features a conversation with author and empath David Sauvage. One thing I'd like to ask of you all is if you enjoy this episode or you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every little bit of support I get helps and helps me keep doing this, which I love. And I especially love having conversations like the one I had with David. He's someone who I would characterize as extraordinarily emotionally intelligent and articulate. And I came across the talks that he does on this Clubhouse app some time ago, and I see as much value in what he does there as anyone I've encountered. One of the things that I talk about frequently is that the way we connect with each other, the way we build intimacy with each other and have meaningful connections in our relationships is by connecting on an emotional level. And this is one of the reasons why I feel like it's very important that we learn how to be emotionally literate, those of us who are challenged with that. This was just a conversation where we went pretty deep, and I guess what I want to say about it is, as I was going through and editing the sound, it just felt good. I felt like David and I created a connection to each other. I felt connected to him, and it's because the depth of the conversation that we had. So it was very satisfying. I think you're going to enjoy it. I know I did. And he's going to go on to do even greater things. So here you go, David Sauvage.
Hey,
thinking about what to say to lead into this with you. And I think one of the things I really appreciate about your presence on Clubhouse is that depth of conversation is very important to me. Like, I don't really enjoy small talk all that much. But if you want to tell me your life story, I'll give you my time. And I've kind of involved myself in several different communities on this app. And I often find myself thinking when a conversation is evolving, man, they're about to strike gold. I hope they stay with it, but they can't tolerate the intimacy of the subject matter. So they end up veering off into something else. But that never happens with you. The rooms that I've been in of yours, there's always an extraordinary amount of depth in the conversation. You're very articulate about the emotional experience. You know your stuff, but you also model the process of navigating through emotions with people. And I just love that. So I appreciate you taking the time to do this. And I'm looking forward to learning about you and how you became this person who so clearly models for us how I think we should live. Because I feel like in our culture, we're really missing the boat with the emotional connection. So I love it. I'm really happy to have you here, and I'm looking forward to learning about you and how you came to do this type of work.
Thank you for that introduction. It feels good. I lose track of what I'm doing a lot of the time. I don't lose track of why. So I'm always connected to the why of what I'm up to, but I'm often disconnected from the how or whether it's making any dent out there or even whether people are sensing it for real. And every once in a while, someone shows up and sees what I think I'm doing, meaning the way you're seeing it is the way that I see it too. And that feels really good. So thank you for that. And I'm happy to answer any question. And yeah. And the more uncomfortable, the better, if that's how you want to go.
Yeah. Well, I will say, I ended up on a stage in one of your rooms a couple weeks ago where you were walking through basically providing a therapy session for a friend of yours who was having sort of an acute anxiety experience, right?
Mm-hmm. Becca.
Yeah, which was awesome. I loved it. And then I messaged you about doing this, and your response was something like, I'm into it, or I'm feeling it. And that's exactly why I wanted to talk to you. And you did it just now. I mean, you're so clear about where you are emotionally, and it's very disarming. And to me, it demonstrates to us how it doesn't have to be a scary thing to live an emotional life. And I think especially guys, we just avoid it. We pretend like it doesn't happen. Yeah, so I'm really excited. So where did you grow up, David?
I grew up in Los Angeles, California, in an area called Laurel Canyon that some of you know the name of. I grew up in a middle class, then upper middle class household. I was born in 1980. The 80s were my childhood. My mother is a lawyer, an entertainment lawyer, a very successful one. My father is a documentary filmmaker and a historian who has had his own share of success. I'm answering all the questions you haven't asked about my childhood, but I feel like I should keep going.
Keep going.
Yeah, it was a very intellectual household. My dad is an intellectual. There were a lot of words and thoughts at the dinner table growing up. There wasn't a lot of feeling, or at least there wasn't a lot of engagement with the emotional level of things, but there was a lot of thinking and talking. So you were pointing at some of my gifts earlier, and one of my gifts is my ability to put things into words. And some of that is innate, but I think a lot of it I learned from my dad, who's also very articulate. And the family I grew up in really prized the ability to put things into words. I have a younger sister, Rebecca, 7 years younger. I went to a mix of public and private schools. Yeah. I smoked a lot of pot in high school. I used to go to the racetrack a lot. My best friends' names were James and Andrew. What else can I tell you?
What were you into as a kid?
Basketball. I was a huge fan of the Lakers. I still am to some extent. Magic Johnson was my idol. I was also an avid table tennis player and actually quite good. Good enough that I could compete in national tournaments. What else was I into? I was into baseball cards. I was into cars a little bit. I remember as a kid, I would driving around, I would point out the fancy cars. Ooh, look at that Ferrari Testarossa. Those really excited me. What else was I into? I was into, not as a kid, but as a teenager, I got really into movies. I was also very much into literature. If you'd asked me who my hero was at 15 or 16, I might have told you Dostoevsky. That's a little about me. I was into writing. I was into theater. Still am. I was into storytelling. Still am.
So you mentioned the Lakers. You said you still are a fan to some extent, I think is how you put it. So I'm curious about this because I grew up in Indiana where basically all you have is sports. So I have teams that I've always followed. And that was also a big part of the emotional connection with my family. We watched basketball together. We watched Notre Dame football together. So there was a strong attachment to it. But having done a lot of work on myself, I found myself, Notre Dame had a really great season in 2012, but every single game was a nail biter. And about halfway through the season, I asked myself, why are you doing this? You know, you're choosing to be on this emotional roller coaster that you really, is this really enjoyable? And ever since then, for the most part, I've really distanced myself a little bit. So is that part of why you've backed away from the Lakers? Does it have anything to do with that?
I was never a big fan of Kobe Bryant's.
Oh.
So when the Lakers...
So much simpler.
There was a period after Magic Johnson and before Kobe Bryant where the Lakers were just not very good. We could call it the Nick Van Exel era. And I lost track of them a bit. And by the time they got good, their star player didn't do it for me. Though I still maintained a connection. And I was still very happy when the Lakers, for instance, beat Boston probably 10 or 15 years ago now with Kobe at the helm. Anyway, so no, I don't think there is a connection between my decreasing interest in the Lakers and my increasing emotional awareness. In fact, there's a sport that I'm an even bigger fan than basketball, though I didn't really become into it until more in my 20s. But I became a huge boxing fan, which is probably surprising to people who follow me. there was a period where I knew more about the sport of boxing than I knew about anything else in the world. I had an encyclopedic knowledge of it. And I could have told you at any given moment, literally, who the top 100 boxers were in the sport off the top of my head. I was that obsessed. In the last few years, that interest has waned. And now I could tell you who 4 or 5 of the best fighters are. And I went from watching 3 or 4 fights a week to 3 or 4 fights a year. So my interest in boxing has waned. And I do, there probably is a correlation between my increased sensitivity to the subtle realms and my decreased interest in the sport of boxing. But that said, there is something about boxing that continues to capture my interest and that I still think is spectacular. And that is that boxing is the most authentic sport that I know of. When you see two boxers fighting, I really feel like you see them. It's very hard for them to pretend. They are just right there. That's who they are, or that's a real part of who they are. And I love that about boxing. And you can't say that about basketball, for instance. You can sort of see how far is somebody willing to go, how much are they willing to put themselves out there. But that's not fundamental to the sport. I'm thinking of a basketball player I really admire who's in his prime right now named Jimmy Butler. If you're a basketball fan, you know who he is. And if you're not, you don't. He's one of those stars that only fans know of. He's not just talented. He's clearly very passionate. And he wears his heart on his sleeve. And a couple of years ago, Miami made a run to the NBA Finals. That was a big surprise. And he was the star of Miami. And you saw him put his body out there game after game, pushing himself all the way to his limit. And you really saw this beautiful man's character. But that is the exception, not the rule in basketball. For the most part, you don't see people's soul in basketball. But if you watch any boxing match, you'll see a man's soul if you know how to look for it. And that's why I loved and still love boxing. But there's also so much toxic masculinity, for lack of a better phrase, and so much inhumanity in the sport, not in the violence so much, but in the sport as a whole, that prevents me from fully enjoying it the way I used to.
So what do you do for a living, David? How do you answer that question?
Badly. It's a struggle for me. It's not a struggle for me in my life, but it's a struggle for me to answer. I think you mean, where do my streams of income come from? And they come from a lot of different directions. One is that I have been holding retreats for a while that does provide some income. Another is that I have, at any moment, somebody can just give me money for what I'm offering to the world. And that provides a little bit. I've also periodically gotten corporate consulting jobs where I'll do a training on emotional intelligence, or recently I helped facilitate a large group of executives to come to a consensus on the name of a brand that they were launching. And that paid relatively well for a relatively minimal amount of time. So I think how I make a living is I keep offering myself in ways that feel good. If people are willing and able to finance me in doing that, that feels great. Sometimes I reluctantly charge for that work. That feels really great. And then sometimes people show up and say, I like what you're doing. Maybe you can help me. And I'm head of HR at such and such company. And that pays the bills too.
So how did you get to this place in life where, I guess, you're an empathy expert? How did this come to be?
Do you mean, how did I get to a place where I feel comfortable saying that I'm an expert at empathy? Or how did I get to a place where the brand seems to make sense? Like, is it a professional question or a personal one?
It's more a personal, your life evolution. What led you to do this type of work?
I think there's something, I'm sure there's something inherent in me that makes me sensitive to other people's emotions. By sensitive, I don't mean more caring. I don't mean more compassionate. I mean literally that I'm more sensitive to the experience of other people's emotions. This is something I was born with. I am, in other words, the word I use for this is an empath. This quality, though, was obscured, even for myself. I didn't know it until about 10 years ago. And what changed was that I started to do real deep healing work on myself. I was, until then, and for a few years after it, really depressed, like very, very depressed. I don't like the word, I mean, I'll use the word depressed because it's accurate, but it doesn't, that word almost feels clinical and doesn't capture the thickness and pain and emptiness and despair that feel truer to me than the word depressed. But anyway, I was quite depressed. And fortunately, I oriented my life around understanding what was going on inside me and working through this depression. That became my singular purpose. And what emerged through that process was that one of, if not the central cause of my depression, was that I was holding other people's emotions in my body. I was like a sponge that kept absorbing, but never releasing. So I went through a multi-year journey of first understanding that, and then second, releasing all of these emotions, most of which weren't mine. And as a consequence, really starting to understand how emotions work, how they interact with the body, how to process them, what a healthy relationship to emotions is. And then this latent sensitivity was right there on the surface. And suddenly I found myself really feeling all of the feelings in a room. Oh, I'm feeling you. You feel anxious. I'm feeling you. You feel sad. I'm feeling you. You feel enthusiastic. And these feelings are floating through my body. My awareness of your experience is because I'm having a subtle version of the experience you're having. And we've talked about this before already, this lucky gift that I have to put things into language that predated all of this. I was always good at that as far back as I can remember speaking. And so combining this newfound sensitivity with my ability to articulate things made me a de facto expert on empathy. I think I also have a natural curiosity for human psychology. I don't think that that's something I had to work for. I think it's just what I get. You know, some people have engineering minds, some people have mathematical minds. Some people are just naturally very creative in certain ways. I'm naturally very psychologically attuned. I'm really curious about what's going on in people's psyches, and I'm really curious about what can be done to help them. So all that together in a soup is how I became a quote-unquote empathy expert. Probably a better phrase that I don't use is just like a human expert or an expert on what's really going on inside people. And one way of thinking about that is in terms of empathy.
So one of the things that I wonder listening to you is, you know, I think I have some of what you're talking about, probably not to the magnitude in terms of the sensitivity to be able to like have an understanding of what someone else is experiencing from an emotional standpoint in a room. And I also believe that at least to some extent, we all have some of this ability. And it's a matter of whether we are tuned into it or not, and whether we're clear enough or not. And you obviously did a lot of work on yourself, and you cleared away the emotion that you were carrying around and made room for the sensitivity to be able to tune in, right? So what are your thoughts on that? Do you think your gift is something that, at least to some degree, all of us have, or it's entirely unique? What do you think about this?
In terms of my gift to feel other people's emotions, I think there's a natural spectrum. And some people are just going to be naturally more sensitive than others, as with everything. My friend Skylar, for instance, is extremely sensitive to sound. She can hear things that I cannot. And that means that when she's in a loud environment, she shuts down much faster than I do. I'm not particularly sensitive to sound, but I am pretty sensitive to feelings, the feeling realm around me. So I would put myself in the top 20% of innate sensitivity, feeling what's going on emotionally in a room. But I wouldn't even put myself in the top 5% or maybe even the top 10%. I think there are a lot of people who are a lot more sensitive than me innately. But most people who are more sensitive than me innately are as blocked or more blocked than I was. Because sensitivity in an insensitive culture, in a culture that does not prize sensitivity, is more of a burden than a gift. And it is easier to close down than it is to open up. There's another important facet here, which is that a lot of people who do have this innate sensitivity, even if they aren't all closed down, they are open to it. They are not going to be as extroverted on the whole as I am. So I'm out there being loud and clear about a gift I have that people who have this same gift tend not to be as able to be as open to, as able to express it as I am. So in a way, I'm standing for a whole bunch of people who are actually more gifted in this very way than I am, but are less able to make a big splash with it. Some of this is also gendered. There's something really interesting about a man owning his sensitivity that people are more apt to listen to than a woman owning her sensitivity, which is a tragic consequence of a fundamentally sexist culture that in some ways I am, as I go out branding myself empath, in some ways I'm benefiting from, but in another way I'm also helping to shift by using this privilege, I think, mostly for good. So I do think it's pretty common. I do think that more and more people are going to be doing and are already doing what I've been doing, which is stepping into it. I think what we need is instead of super sensitive types like myself, and maybe you, and maybe the people listening, instead of it all being on us to own our sensitivity, to work through all the underlying trauma that's in the way, then if you have the voice to express your sensitivity so that other people can understand it, I think that's putting much too much of a burden on the sensitive types. What we need is a whole cultural shift that values sensitivity and empathy the way we value, let's say, productivity. And until that shift happens, we're not going to be able to really see and appreciate how many of us have these gifts and what a beautiful world we could create if given the opportunity to lead with them.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you talk about this a lot. So how do we get there? What's the first step to move in that direction as a culture? What do you think?
Well, let's give ourselves some credit. Now we're two white men with a lot of other options on a relatively small stage, but a stage nonetheless, having an authentic conversation around empathy and emotions and authenticity with a lot of care and heart. And that is rare, but it is not unheard of. And I feel like more and more people are doing it. So it is changing. I feel a shift. I feel like this kind of conversation is more available now than it was 5 or 10 years ago. So maybe the first step is to start appreciating, or one step among many parallel steps. I don't know if there is one way for it, but one thing we can do is to start appreciating where it is happening, to start appreciating ourselves for the value of our sensitivity. My friend has come to stay with me here in my house in upstate New York, and when she was on the plane coming here, she had a burst of anxiety and had trouble breathing. And the woman next to her turned to her and felt her anxiety and said very intuitively, "How would it feel if I prayed with you?" And my friend Katie said to her, "It would feel really good." And this woman prayed with Katie, or for Katie, and it helped calm Katie down. So maybe I can appreciate this woman, whose name I don't even know, who is able to attune to and help my friend Katie. Maybe what we need to do a little at a time is to appreciate those moments where that world that is oriented around sensitivity, empathy, care, shows up. Because it is here. It is here sometimes, and we feel it. And let's give ourselves credit, and let's give people credit for embodying it, which is what you were doing at the beginning of this podcast, and it felt really good. More of that. That feels like part of it. And then there's another part of it, too, that's bubbling up in me. It's a whole different archetype. And it's a bit of the warrior archetype. There is another part of me that doesn't just want to appreciate the sensitives among us, doesn't just want to nurture and cultivate this new and beautiful world. There's a part of me that also wants to fight for it. And I don't actually think it's enough to hold with love and care and compassion the emergent new beautiful world. I do think that some of us are going to need to stand inside the old world, or at least at the threshold, and say things like, enough. This needs to stop. We need to recognize that the people who are running the show are not in their hearts, are not aware of their own emotional experience, and therefore, by definition, are not attuned to others, and that the power that they have accumulated by virtue of navigating an inhuman system should not be theirs. And I will not roll over and allow them to pave a parking lot over the trees in my backyard. So, like, what's coming up for me here, as an example, is if a week ago or so, Mark Zuckerberg changed the name of Facebook to Meta, because he has a vision of all of us living in a alternate virtual reality metaverse that undoubtedly he would like to control and monetize. And he is not remotely attuned to the subtle energetics of what's going on here in this realm. So the world that he is seeking to create will inevitably be even more numbing, even more disconnected. And how is it that we can even accept this as anything but a pathetic joke? How is it that we are in a world where he has trillions of dollars, or many hundreds of billions of dollars, to create this dystopian nightmare? I don't accept it. I will stand up and say no. And more of us need to do that too. It's not enough to hold with care and compassion the beautiful world that is emerging. I think we also need to look at the toxic one that we're emerging from and stop it before it runs roughshod over whatever is left of our planet and our social lives.
I love this because I think we're going to have to fight for it at some point, and I think we should. And I don't know, I tune in a lot to men's issues and men's relationships with their emotions, and you know, the idea of toxic masculinity and how so many men conflate that idea with masculinity itself, and the idea that there's something wrong with shedding tears, and which is really just a crock, right? I mean, it's ridiculous because it's that in particular is another bodily function. And would we restrict any of our other bodily functions? And if we did, what would that look like? And essentially, we're getting the same result by, you know, living in a culture where so many men bottle up their tears. It comes out in nastiness. To me, that's what toxic masculinity is. It's when the emotions aren't processed the way that they should be, and then men are carrying them around, and they're gonna inevitably come out in ugly ways, right? To me, that's what it really is. But I've also had this feeling that it's not enough to explain it, but also just to call out the stupidity of how historically we've related to our emotions, especially as men in this culture. I do a men's group once a week, and one of the guys, it's intimate. So if somebody needs to shed tears, they shed tears. And someone was talking about, we're talking about our fathers and if we saw them cry. And one of them, the only time he ever saw his father cry was at his father's best friend's funeral. And he shed tears. And the moment he realized that his wife and kids were witnessing that, he left in shame, pretended it didn't happen. You know, I mean, that's crazy, right? I mean, that's it's so common. And I don't know how I got on this little diatribe or what you want to say about it, but any thoughts?
Yeah, you did a good job of expressing how insane it is that we would value numbness or gross displays of power or toughness or winning or competitiveness or determination, which are all sort of hyper-masculine traits, some of which are of value. Let's not diminish them all. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, but that we would value all of those qualities and completely diminish, trivialize, or cast shame around sadness or vulnerability or just plain old feeling. And yeah, I'm with you there. I think because you did a good job of calling out the bullshit, I'll counter it with some compassion. But if you had been super compassionate, I might have called out the bullshit. I think we need both. I will say that toxic masculinity is a perfectly understandable trauma response to a childhood that demanded that you be tough. When a boy is told to toughen up, for instance, a boy doesn't know how to process that. If you tell a six-year-old boy who's crying, you need to toughen up, the boy does not know how to toughen up. So what the boy hears is, you need to find a way to not feel what you're feeling. And the way to not feel what you're feeling is to dissociate and become numb. And from that place, the dissociated, numb place, when you look around and you see how are people surviving and thriving in this world, what you come to is that this world is a might makes right kind of place. Whether we're talking about professional sports, where toxic masculinity is still the norm, the NFL is a perpetual showcase of toxic masculinity. Boxing is a perpetual showcase of toxic masculinity. We still value it. Politics is a perpetual showcase of toxic masculinity, left and right. So when you look around, you're already numb and you're trying to figure out how to survive in this world. It makes a ton of sense that you would just be like, I'm going to be a dude, or I'm going to blah, right. This energy. And so we have unprocessed trauma at the root of it. And men are not the only ones to blame. My mom didn't teach me particularly well, though she meant well, but she didn't know how to help me connect with my feelings. She didn't know what another model would look like. So we're all in this mess together, men and women.
Absolutely. And I'm the youngest of eight. I have five sisters, and my oldest sister, there's so many times we've spoken on the phone when she said, no, I told myself I'm not going to cry, as if that's some sort of badge of honor, right? Like, I am imposing when I'm feeling.
Breaks my heart when women apologize for crying. Breaks my every yeah. time. And it happens to me all the time because I'm with people who are in very vulnerable situations. And a woman is crying and she's like, I'm so sorry. As if her tears are somehow an imposition on me. I'm so sorry that so many women feel like their feelings are impositions, especially onto men. That's just another sign of how sideways our culture is.
Yeah, and I think about how in order for me to be able to be vulnerable with you or to have the courage to clearly express what I'm experiencing emotionally, which is how I like to think of it, you have to be able to receive it, right? And if you can't, if the recipient of the message can't tolerate it, then they have a trauma response to it, which is basically they're unconsciously saying, you can't come to me with stuff like this. Don't ever do that again, right? And I think that happens a lot too. So on the personal level, it becomes a matter of finding our people who we can talk to, because so many people aren't equipped to do it.
Yes. You know, this is making me, I have something to say before we go on, which is like,
okay,
I feel like what we're actually saying here is just so simple too. I feel like I can summarize what it is to be an emotionally mature and properly oriented human in a healthy world. And it's basically that we're looking to shift our relationship to our emotions. Most of us make enemies, are in the habit of making enemies out of different emotions. So maybe you're uncomfortable with feeling anger. You don't feel justified being angry. So when you feel anger, you shame yourself for being angry. Or maybe it doesn't feel good to feel sad. And what we want to shift here is we want to start making friends with all of our emotions, both the emotions that show up on the surface and then the emotions that are deeper and hiding. We want to make friends with the emotions that we have about our emotions. So, oh, I feel ashamed that I feel jealous. Wonderful. You feel both shame and jealousy. Can you make friends with that? This is a healthy orientation around your emotions. Sometimes the emotions are absolutely overwhelming and you can't cope. And that is okay. You do not want to force yourself to experience things you can't cope with. In that case, you can distract yourself ideally in healthy ways, and if possible, seek out help, because other people, emotionally aware people, or even people who connect with us, can help us regulate emotions when they become overwhelming. And what you'll find the more you do this kind of work is that what is underneath many of your emotions, especially the really intense and pleasant ones, is trauma. Sometimes that trauma is something that happened in your own life, and sometimes that trauma is trauma that you inherited from your parents, from your grandparents, from your lineage, from your race, from your culture. And the work is to recognize these traumas in yourself, which ain't easy. Oh, what's going on here is trauma. I'm having a trauma response. And then to start orienting around healing. As you do this healing work, you'll notice that more and more of your organic, authentic energy comes back to you. You start to feel, in essence, more and more like yourself. And now inspiration is more available to you. Purpose is more available to you. Joy is more available to you. And another thing that becomes more available to you is your ability to be with other people in their experience. The reason it is so hard is to really be with other people in their emotional experience, especially if their experience is really painful or unpleasant, is because you haven't yet learned how to be with yourself in your own pain. So the more you learn to be with yourself, the more you can authentically be there for others. And then we start to create these new kinds of communities that are oriented around the authentic experience of each individual and their true and authentic needs, where we are in touch with ourselves and helping other people to be in touch with themselves. And we're having open and honest and often uncomfortable and vulnerable and awkward dialogues about what's really going on with each other. And what we will start to find, and what I'm starting to find in my own life, is when we are able to do that, there emerges through the group, through any group, a kind of higher order intelligence that will guide us together in a way no individual ever has to figure out on his or her own, just through the surrender to this higher intelligence that emerges organically when we do enough of our own healing. We surrender to this new world bubbling up. That's all I'm talking about. That's it. That's what I'm saying over and over again in 100 different forms. This is the truth that I think humanity has been on the precipice of uncovering and naming for quite a long time. I don't think I'm saying anything original. I'm saying anything original here. I'm 100% sure I'm saying nothing original here. But this is the holy grail that I believe we've all been looking for. This is it. This is all we're talking about. It ain't easy. It's hard as hell, but it is the way.
There's a quote that I really like by an author named Sam Keen. He says, "We can only choose whether we will feel and not what we will feel."
So true. Good quote, Sam. Thank you.
Yeah, but I know for me, I think a lot of us have tried to, for many years of my life, to avoid the emotions to which we attach a negative value. I remember maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I was walking on the beach with this friend of mine, and I was 40, you know, and I was talking to her about my day-to-day life. And I mentioned, you know, on Monday evenings, I generally feel pretty lonely. And I realized that's the first time I ever said that about myself in my entire life. I just never said it. It can't possibly be true. And one of the real gateway for me in my own healing over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, I've been on a healing path for a long time, and I had all the information about adverse experiences and could talk about them and was willing to share those stories with people. But what I had never done until a couple years ago was look down from 1,000 feet at the situation and own the fact that, wow, that makes for a pretty sad childhood. I never owned the sadness. And when I gave myself permission to do that and to feel through it, and, you know, I literally set aside time to shed tears. Like, you can feel when you need to. I can. And I kind of made that a priority for a while. And what I found when I started to unload all this stuff that I was carrying around, then it made room for joy. It made room for all the good stuff. But you've used the word numbing several times in this conversation. And I think that's really what it is. Either we feel our feelings or we don't. We don't get to choose which emotional experience. Either we're going to show up for it or we're not, you know?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And I want to cut off at the pass the usual objection to this beautiful and clear distillation around feeling. So the quote was, you can choose whether you feel, but you don't get to choose what you feel. And there's a lot of stories to the contrary out there that you do get to choose what you feel. And there's the ring of truth. You can, for instance, think of a happy memory. You can choose to think of a happy memory, and then you might feel some of the feelings associated with that memory. And so we could say on one level that you're choosing to feel happy. There are some people who make whole careers out of teaching people this. So you call in a thought or a vision or an idea. Emotions arise in relationship to that. If you do that enough, then in theory, you're changing your baseline emotional experience, and you are therefore choosing to feel another emotion. I have some bad news for you, though, if you've been approaching your life that way. And I have much worse news for you if that's what you teach, which is that you are not building on an authentic foundation. And the underlying emotions that you are trying to jump out of by calling in happier thoughts will still be there waiting to be felt. And so if you put less effort into trying to cultivate positive emotions and put more effort into trying to accept the emotions that organically bubble up, you will find, paradoxically, that you will feel more positive emotions ultimately. And those emotions will be felt at a much deeper level, all the way to the bottom, because you have been cultivating an authentic relationship with yourself. So at the deepest level, you can't really change what you're feeling, though you can do some hacks to feel momentarily better. But hey, I'd rather go the real and deep and honest way toward bliss and truth than the shortcut way toward momentary feelings of fleeting satisfaction that require you to go back to that method again and again.
Mm. Well, so there's one question I ask of every guest at the end of the conversation. So if there was a time in your life when you could go back to the younger David, when he would have needed some support or a word of advice or encouragement, when would he have needed it most? And what would you go back and say?
Oh, I'm 8 years old. It's my birthday. I'm at a combination arcade batting, one of those places where you bat, batting cage, go-kart racing kind of place in LA somewhere. I've got about 15 or 20 friends around. And for some reason, I still can't remember. I'm really, really sad. Maybe somebody said something to me just a few minutes before that made me really sad. But now it's time for the cake. And my mother lights the candles. And she walks the cake over to me as everyone sings happy birthday. And I see on my mother's face that she really needs me to be happy right now, even though my truth is that I am sad. And this moment was absolutely overwhelming to me. And I checked out of my experience and gave my mom the face I sensed she wanted and became a happy automaton, numbing out the sadness that was truly present. I would like to go back, and I think I often do. I go back to that 8-year-old boy after he blows out the candles while his mom is cutting the cake, and I say to him, it really is okay to be sad right now. And I can hear him respond with, it's not okay for mom. And my response to him is, you're right, it's not okay for mom, but your feelings matter too, not just mom's feelings. And I can hear him respond, but she'd be really mad at me. She really wants everyone to be happy right now. And I respond to him, I hear you, and it's going to be really, really hard for you when she's mad at you for being sad, but it's more important that you are authentically sad than fake happy. And now he looks at me a little bit confused, and he said, what do you mean by authentically? And I said, you're really sad, be really sad, and when mom gets mad at you for being sad, try your best to ignore her and find some friends you can be sad with, and you'll feel better. And he seems to understand that advice.
Well, I've never had anyone with such an elaborate response, and that was beautiful. Thank you. There you go. Thanks for listening. David Savage. You can find him all over Clubhouse. Again, if you enjoyed the show, please leave a rating or review or both at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Share it with someone. Maybe even post about it. Every little bit of support helps. For access to supplemental content, including early access to this episode, which was available several days before it was publicly released, and all episodes, you can find the show on Patreon. That's patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Thank you to the show's sponsor, The Manor and Windrose Recovery. Thank you to the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. Got some great episodes coming up. I'm pretty excited. There's one in particular who just got to book the interview. A really cool author who I've been trying to get on the show for a while. So yeah, keep coming back. Sincerely, I thank you for investing your time in listening to this, listening to me. I appreciate it. So I hope you guys have a great week. Be good to each other. Be nice.
That's our story. I hope you enjoyed the punk rock opera. One last piece of music for you. Goes like this.
Okay, go. makers, we are the Jedi Smith!
Generation, self-made bands, we cut our teeth with bloody hands. The rage that's instilled in us can feed a crowd.
Thank you.